Hello. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here today. My name is Meredith Goldstein. I'm a writer for the Boston Globe. I write about entertainment, trends, and I also write an advice column called Love Letters, which is probably why they asked me to moderate today's panel. We have three wonderful writers here today who pretty much cover, I think, every part of love in some way. I'm sure you're here because you've heard of them, or at least are interested in them. But I will tell you that I spent the last few months reading and rereading their books, and as I like to say, I had all of the feelings, all of them. But what I found best is that in all situations, I was laughing frequently with these books. So I hope that if you have not already read them, you will find them later, and it's just... These are writers with fantastic senses of humor. So just to get a few things out of the way, at the end of today's panel, your instinct is going to be to run to your new favorite authors. That should not be your instinct. It should be to go back to that corner where they will be with their books. So as soon as we're done, just please, that's the direction, if you can take a look. The other thing I will tell you is that the Boston Book Festival is always timed with my week of fall allergies. 2 years ago, when I was presenting, I was so allergic that it looked as though I had been moved to tears by the panelists, when in fact, I think it might have been my eye makeup. Today, I promise you at one point, I will blow my nose, and it will be epic, into this microphone and with the acoustics in this church. So get ready. And please know that especially in the world we are in today, it's not contagious, it's just allergies, I swear. So anyway, I'm just going to start. What I'm going to do today is introduce each of these wonderful writers and then allow them to share a little bit of their recent book with you. And then at the end, I'll ask some questions. We will move to questions. Okay. I'm going to start with Jennifer Finney Boylan, who is all the way to my right. Jenny is an advocate for transgender equality and a writer who my editor of the book section at the Boston Globe said, oh, she writes beautiful sentences, which I thought was an incredible compliment, because it's just not something I think about, beautiful sentences, but she does. She's the Anna Quinlan writer in residence at Barnard. She's often known for her 2003 autobiography, She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders. This new book, Stuck in the Middle with You, and by the way, all of these authors have great book titles. So we'll get to that, because I feel like you named your own. But Stuck in the Middle with You is a fantastic name for a book about parenting, first as a father, then as a mother. I just have to say that this book is about parenting, but it's very much about relationships. And as someone who receives a lot of letters from people who are trying to deal with marriage, for as unique as this situation is in Jenny's book, so many times did I stop and think, oh, I've heard this 1,000 times before, that to be married for a long time is a wonderful challenge. And I got so much out of this book, just about what it's like to keep the same people in your life as family for a long time. So I was very moved by it. So would you mind starting us off?
Thanks. Hey, everybody. So, hello. I'm going to read a short piece to get things started. This piece is less about... can I step down here?
Yes.
A little closer to you all?
Preach.
Leading the mothership here. So this is... it goes back to the very beginning of my relationship with my wife. We've been married for 26 years as of this last summer. 12 as husband and wife, 14 as wife and wife. So here's a kind of a standalone piece called In the Early Morning Rain. When I was young, there was a time when I figured, the hell with it. I'd never even said the word transgender out loud. I couldn't imagine saying it. I mean, come on, please. So instead, one day, a few years after I got out of college, I loaded all my things into the Volkswagen and just started driving. I wasn't sure where I was going, but I knew that I wanted to get away from the Maryland spring with its cherry blossoms and its bursting tulips and all its bullshit. I figured I'd keep driving farther and farther north until there weren't any people. I wasn't sure what I was going to do then, but I was certain something would occur to me that would end this transgender business once and for all. And so, I set my sights on Nova Scotia. I drove to Maine, and I took a ferry out of Bar Harbor. I drove onto the SS Blue Nose and stood on the deck and watched America drift away behind me, which, as far as I was concerned, was just fine. There was someone walking around in a rabbit costume on the ship. He'd pose with you, and then they'd snap your picture, and an hour or so later, you could purchase the photo of yourself with the rabbit as a memento of your trip to Nova Scotia. I purchased mine. It showed a sad-looking boy, I think that's a boy, with long hair reading a book of poetry as a moth-eaten rabbit bends over him. In Nova Scotia, I drove the car east and north for a few days. When dusk came, I'd eat in a diner, and then I'd sleep either in the car or in a small tent that I had in the back. There were scattered patches of snow up there, even in May. I kept going north until I got to Cape Breton, which is about as far away as you can get from Baltimore and still be on dry land. In Cape Breton, I hiked around the cliffs, looked at the ocean. At night, I lay in my sleeping bag by the sea as breezes shook the tent. I wrote in my journal or read the poetry of Robert Frost or grazed around in the modern library's great tales of horror and the supernatural. I read one up there called, "Oh, Whistle, and I'll Come to You, My Lad." In the car, I listened to the Warlocks sing "In the Early Morning Rain" on the tape deck, which is a song that goes, "In the early morning rain, with a dollar in my hand, and an aching in my heart, and my pockets full of sand, I'm a long way from home, and I miss my loved one so. In the early morning rain, with no place to go." Thought about this girl I knew, Grace Finney. I thought about my parents. I thought about the clear, inescapable fact that I was female in spirit and how, in order to be whole, I'd have to give up on every dream I'd ever had except one. I stayed in a motel one night that was officially closed for the season, but the operator let me stay there for half price. I opened up my suitcase and put on my bra and some jeans and a blue knit top. I combed my hair out and looked in the mirror and saw a relatively normal looking young woman. "This is so wrong," I said to myself in the mirror. "This is the cause of all the trouble." I thought about settling in one of the little villages around there, just starting life over as a woman. I could tell everyone I was Canadian. Then I lay on my back and sobbed. Nobody would ever believe I was Canadian. The next morning, I climbed a mountain at the far northern edge of Cape Breton Island. I climbed to the top, trying to clear my head, but it wouldn't clear. I kept going up and up, past the tree line, past the shrub line, until at last there was just moss. And there I stood, looking out at the cold ocean, 1,000 miles below me, totally cut off from the world. A fierce wind blew in from the Atlantic. I leaned into it. I saw the waves crashing against the cliff below. I stood right at the edge. My heart pounded. I leaned over the edge of the precipice, but the gale blowing into my body kept me from falling. When the wind died down, I'd start to fall, then it would blow me back up again. I played a little game with the wind, leaning a little further over the edge each time. And then I leaned at the edge of the cliff at a sharp angle, my arms held outward like wings, my body sustained only by that fierce wind, and I thought, "Well, is this what you've come here for then? Shall we?" And then a huge blast of wind blew me backwards, and I landed on the moss. It was soft. I stared up at the blue sky and I felt something. "Are you all right?" said the voice. "You're going to be all right. You're going to be okay. Looking back now, I'm still not sure whose voice that was. My guardian angel? The ghost of my father? I don't know. Does it really change things all that much to give a name to the spirits that are looking out for us? Still, from this vantage point, over 25 years later, my heart tells me that was the voice of my future self, the woman that I eventually became, a woman who, all these years later, looks more or less like the one I saw in the mirror in the motel. Looking back on that young man, I want to tell him, it will get better. It will not always hurt the way it hurts now. The thing that right now you fear is your greatest curse will someday turn out to be, against all odds, your greatest gift. It's hard to be gay or lesbian. To be trans can be harder. There have been plenty of times when I've lost all hope. But in the years since I heard that voice saying, "Are you all right? You're going to be okay," I found, to my surprise, most people have treated me with love. Many of the people I most expected to lose when I came out as trans turned out to be loving and compassionate and kind. I can't tell you how to get here from there. You have to figure that out, your own self. But I do know that instead of going off that cliff, I walked back down the mountain that day and instead began the long, long journey toward home. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our next writer is Margot Howard, and I went to Hilton Head with a friend last week and had two glasses of wine and tried to pretend that I can handle two glasses of wine, which I can't. And I was trying to come up with an intro for Margot because it's sort of hard because Margot's my friend. So it's hard to be objective about all the things that make Margot Margot. And in my drunken, Riesling-fueled state, I wrote down, she's like the Harry Potter of divorce. I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means, but now if she ever wants a blurb, that's what it's going to say, and everybody will be like, what? Margot has a long history of being a reporter and a writer, and I actually think it's her reporting background that makes her so readable and smart as an advice columnist. She wrote as Dear Prudence, and then eventually as Dear Margot, and now she has written a book called Eat, Drink, and Remarry, which is about doing all of those things. And I will say this about Margot, and now I'm going to embarrass us both. I was trying to convey how open she is, because that is one of the things about Margot, that she will tell you anything. And I will tell you that before we came on here, we both had to go to the bathroom, and there was one bathroom, and it's like a one-y, you know, like a one stall. And she was like, just come in here. So we both, you know, went to the bathroom in the same room together, and I was like, this is Margot. Everyone should know. We're just in the same bathroom together because she shares. So, share, Margot.
Well, this book really is about my destiny. And that was to never be a bridesmaid, but always a bride. There is, of course, a chapter per husband. So that's four chapters right there. And there are a few loose chapters that make sense of the others. And I'm going to read you the second chapter, which follows the chapter where I am a 20-year-old intern for Hubert Humphrey in Washington, if you know who Hubert Humphrey was. And that was before the invention of the thong. So there was no sex between the senator and myself. So during that summer, I got engaged to a lovely young man. By the end of the summer, I was unengaged. And I returned to my senior year at Brandeis. Later in 1960, when I returned to school for my senior year, a hallmate fixed me up on a blind date with her fiancé's cousin. This man had purple Cadillac and not a lot of hair. He was also a smidgen shorter than I, and at 5'2", I was no Amazon. Being a bit of a brat and reading the tea leaves, I announced when I saw him that I felt the onset of a spastic colon attack, and we could either bag the date or I could go and just have tea. I should not have offered him multiple choice because he chose to continue with the date. We wound up at Loch Ober Cafe, my favorite restaurant in Boston, and I was stuck with a pot of tea and him. Apparently, he was a perceptive chap because he quietly determined that this date was a twofer, the first and the last. And so it was that he suggested that his good friend John Coleman call me because Coleman was planning to move to Chicago and I was from Chicago. My first date with Coleman was not what anyone would call auspicious. He collected me in Waltham and basically did not talk to me for the drive into Boston, which at that time took about 40 minutes. I made a stab at drawing him out, but with little polysyllabic success. He was a freckled redhead, trim, of average height. His facial structure was sharp angles, and he was also somewhat chin deficient, which seemed rather English, and that to me suggested being distinguished looking. Were I describing him today, I would say he looked like an unattractive Prince Charles. But I was never one of those girls particularly drawn to guys with traditional good looks. We went to the Ritz-Carlton for dinner with a married couple he had invited, and then on to the movie premiere of West Side Story. Interesting, a first date with a guarantee of no conversation for 2 hours. He also left his seat 3 times to smoke. I smoked too then, but I never interrupted a movie to do it. It did not register in any serious way that he was one of those people who, as Jewish grannies used to say, had spilkes. A fair translation would be ants in your pants. He asked me out again, and I accepted, probably hoping he would talk this time. He did. On our second date, I found out he was 5 years older than I, and that he was working at Tucker Anthony and RL Day in Boston, learning the investment banking ropes. He did mention that starting in the 6th grade, he was reading Barron's. He'd gone to prep school and then to college at Rutgers. After graduating, he went to Harvard Business School, but dropped out during his first semester, deciding that he knew more than they did. The drama of his life was that he was adopted. Everyone in his family knew, but he did not find out until age 20, when he went to City Hall for a passport. Perhaps this situation, both traumatic and angering, contributed to his chilliness. He was, however, showering me with attention and wanted to get together every night. This I could not do, but we did have 4 dates and in a week and a half. Things moved fast and I was strangely drawn to him, perhaps because he was such a controlled personality. And I couldn't help but embark on the unconscious challenge to get through to him, making me, I guess, one of those icebreaker ships and him the iceberg. On the 4th date, he told me he was madly in love with me and asked me to marry him. Reader, I said yes. Do not ask me why, because I could not tell you. It was then that he told me he had a minor bit of business to take care of. He needed to get a divorce. A what? Where was she, I asked. Was he dating even though he was still married? Well, he explained, they'd been separated for much of their 2-year marriage, and he had not planned to rush into a divorce, but now, of course, his plans had changed. I accepted his explanation and went along with the engagement. I really do not know what possessed me. I'd had a romantic history of boyfriends who were smitten with me, warm and devoted. All I can figure out in retrospect is that his very different kind of personality was somewhere between a change and a challenge for me, and I was intrigued. A rare tribute, perhaps, to be chosen by a man who seemed so aloof, but loved me. His personality exhibited characteristics I had never experienced in a romance before. He was introverted and remote, the classic loner. And he was driven. There was something of a wounded soul about him that called out to me. It was as though he needed me. Think Jay Gatsby if he found Florence Nightingale instead of Daisy Buchanan.
I said they were going to be funny, right? It's not easy to be Daniel Jones for so many different reasons. About a year ago, I was talking to a friend who was very upset about the relationship she was in because her boyfriend, she claimed, was addicted to driving Uber. And she said, you know, really, it's addictive, apparently, because one more hour, you just get that many more fares. And as she's, you know, borderline tears and looking for empathy, I'm thinking, oh, my God, that would make such a good modern love column. It's so timely. And I find that modern love in the New York Times just always seems to tap into both universal problems and timeless problems, but also problems that are happening right now. And this person is basically thrown, I can't even imagine how many submissions you have.
It's about 5,000 a year.
About 5,000 a year. It's a lot of misery and happiness and emotion. And, you know, you can think about all the things he must learn from reading about all of these people's love lives. And luckily, he has written a book about all that he's learned. And it's very funny. It does not give you all the answers, but it kind of gives you a lot of answers, more than I thought, just about trends. And there were so many poignant parts of this book, especially for me as someone who receives problems that are written a little bit differently, that I'm so curious to know what part you're going to read. I think it will be very telling. So please share with us and talk about the book.
Thank you, Meredith, and thank you to everyone who's here. It's really a pleasure to be here, and especially with these two women who, both of whom I published. I don't know if that was taken into consideration when this panel was created. They may not remember it, but I do. And so I've been editing this column now for 10 years. Next Sunday is the 10-year anniversary of the first published column, which appeared on Halloween Day, scarily enough. And I remember when it started, and I was sort of concerned about job security, and I asked the style editor at that time how long he expected this sort of thing to last. And he said, I don't know, 1 year, 3 years, something like that. And the fact that it just sort of continues, and the audience and continues to expand and the submissions continue to grow is very heartening to me. It makes me very happy. As Meredith said at the beginning, reading these submissions, which over 10 years is roughly 50,000, I'm the only person that this email address comes to. Sometimes these submissions are addressed to my staff, which makes me laugh. No one really has staff at the time. It all just comes to me, and I open every single one and at least read the beginning of every single one and read a lot of them all the way through, more than you would think. By the way, I'm just going to read a very short bit, but I wanted to talk a little bit first. And so sorting through all these, people are writing about problems, and sometimes it's the most grievous problem that they've ever encountered, and they can be very tragic. And being immersed in this every day for so many years had left me feeling sort of depressed and confused. And I didn't really want to feel that way anymore. It made me feel 5% inspired, too, but very depressed and confused. And I wanted to make sense of what all these stories were telling me and what the commonalities were and what the trends were. And I wanted to do it in a way that would be it would be fun, because these are common problems, and I don't care what your situation is, these sorts of yearnings are universal, and I think that's what the column taps into with an audience. So I wanted to find out what I could, in pulling my head sort of out of the weeds and looking at what I'd published and what I hadn't published, what I could learn and maybe what I could teach. And that's what I did with the book, Love Illuminated. So then I went off on tour with this book last winter. It came out in February. And I went all around the country, and I had the best time because I had authors. I published 500 authors at this point. And at every stop along the way, I was either on stage, I either had events like this one where I was with people I'd published, or I was meeting them. And I wanted to acknowledge them in some way and give them a token of that would identify them to the world as a modern love essayist. This was not something the Times was going to pay for or my publisher was going to pay for, and I didn't want to spend that much on it, as much as I care about all of these lovely people. So I went online and found, you know, like those Lance Armstrong bracelets people use for fundraising or whatever, and I found this place that sells those. And you could engrave them. You don't really engrave rubber, but whatever the word is for engraving rubber. So they would say Modern Love Essayist. And this particular year was the first year that they made them in the shape of a heart. And I thought, well, that's just perfect. So I had about 700 of these made up. And this is what they are. So it's a really, I thought this was, you know, this was just priceless. And I thought it was a really good idea until I actually put it on. And it turns out that a wrist is not heart-shaped, but it sort of stands up like that in what I thought of as looking like a sunburned ass. Which was perfectly appropriate, I thought, because what else is the modern love column but an overexposed private part? So, Jenny?
That brings us to me.
You don't have to wear it out. But
well, thank you for this.
Go?
I'll treasure it.
Thank you.
Always.
All right.
Sweet.
Now that business is taken care of.
Wow.
So people, there are, you know, hundreds of people wearing these around the country.
You mean you've given them 200?
And they're wearing them. Okay. So I'm just going to read a couple of pages from actually the introduction to this book. I decided that I would organize the book around questions and around a quiz. Because as I was researching how do you write a book about love, because writing a book about love has actually been done before, a lot of them began with quizzes. And I thought, well, this book doesn't really have answers. I'm glad Meredith did find some. But I was more interested in these questions that don't really change, whether it's modern love or love from 300 years ago. And so I organized the book around 10 questions that I didn't think, you know, any of them had any real answers. And this is just a couple of pages introducing myself, I guess. At the New York Times, I edit a personal essay column called Modern Love, in which strangers spill their guts about their relationship woes. It's a job I have worked at more or less full-time for the past 9 years, a period during which some 50,000 laments about love have filtered through my brain and often my heart. The stories arrive by email around the clock, pouring into my laptop, dribbling out of my printer, and spilling across the tables of my office and home. They follow me into bed at night, tag along on family vacations, and ping into my iPhone when I'm walking my dogs or standing on the sidelines of my son's soccer games. They are frequently told to me in person, at cocktail parties, at public events, like this one, I'm sure, and in planes, trains, and automobiles. When people find out what I do, they invariably say, "You must know a lot about love." Or they might invoke the name of the newspaper sex columnist, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, on Sex and the City, and remark, "You're like a male Carrie Bradshaw." The first person to make that observation was a journalist who interviewed me early on in my job, when I was so out of the loop love-wise that I didn't even know who Carrie Bradshaw was. I thought the journalist had said, "Terry Bradshaw," the famous Steelers quarterback, now Fox Sports analyst, I'd grown up idolizing during my suburban Pittsburgh childhood. It didn't occur to me to ask what Terry Bradshaw had to do with editing confessional essays about relationships. All I could think was, "I'm like a male Terry Bradshaw?" But he is male. Shows how little I knew about love back then. Now, 9 years later, I apparently know enough about love to fill a book. Thanks.
All right, so I want to leave plenty of time for questions. I kept tweeting about this event, and for some reason I always think people need to be bribed to come to book events, which is crazy because look at all of you here. Uh-huh. You'll notice I have like two big sacks of Halloween candy out there. Please take on your way out. I also brought three. I was at a Globe-sponsored event about a week ago, and the Globe makes really weird swag, not as weird as sunburnt ass that you're all wearing, really weird swag, and I stole some of it, and I decided that I was going to give some of the weird swag to the first three people who ask questions. So just know that, you know, if you're thinking about waiting till the end, you want to get this swag. One is a Boston Globe massager. I don't know why they make this. No, it does not vibrate. This is a first aid kit because when you are bleeding, we want you to think of the Boston Globe. And this is a sewing kit. It says the Boston Globe on it. No, I'm sorry. It's tweezers. Even weirder. So I'm just going to start by asking a question or two, and then I'm really going to leave it to you because I know you have plenty of questions. My therapist once said to me, well, of course you write about relationships and your own relationships in memoir style, because then you get to decide what information is important. You get to decide the beginning, the middle, and the end, and how much control that must give you. Good therapist. And I wonder, you know, Dan, you see this with how people arrange their stories, and the two of you have written about yourselves. Is there a certain amount of therapy and relief in being able to sort of control the narrative of what you've experienced? And when you write memoir, do you approach it that way? You know, how do you decide what is the beginning and what is the end of this book or this essay? I'm going with Margot first. I'm picking on you first.
Okay. I do not write therapeutic books. Technically, this is my third memoir, but that was said of me. It's nothing I would say of myself. My first book was about my grandparents and my mother and her terrible twin sister and myself, and we call it a Jewish Dallas. I mean, it was just this big thing that I don't consider a memoir, but other people do. My second book was letters from my mother to me spanning more than 40 years. I didn't consider that a memoir, but other people did. This definitely is a memoir, but it's a marital memoir. And as I say, it wasn't therapeutic. I just write because I like to write and I like to tell stories. There were limits on me. I mean, I only had four husbands, so I knew what I had to write about. Yeah. So to that extent, I had no control.
Good answer, Jenny.
Well, I think the irony is that we all know that writing can be great therapy. I mean, everyone's been told that, oh, we should write this out. Get this out on paper. You'll feel so much better. So I think it's undeniable that writing can be really good for you. But just because it's good for you doesn't necessarily mean that it's good for the reader, right? And in fact, I think there's probably an inverse relationship between how satisfying it was to express and how interesting it is for the reader. And, you know, I think, what was that John Lennon piece about his mother? The one about, "Mother, you left me," and at the end of it, he was doing primal scream therapy, and for like the last like 2 minutes, he's just, okay, sound guy, turn off my mic for a second. Okay. And you don't really want to listen to this. I don't really want to listen to this time, even if it's John Lennon. And so, with transgender people, and there's a lot of trans writers. I think the temptation is to write from our pain. This is true of not just trans people, but everybody. If you write from your pain, it can feel good. But other people are less interested in your pain than they are in whether or not you have a story to tell. And so, ultimately. It's really frustrating because you express yourself, you get it out on paper, and then the reader wants to know, yeah, but are there any good jokes?
Right.
Yeah. Or is there any truth?
Yeah. And Dan, do you see a pattern in how people start and stop their stories, how they choose to frame the narrative?
Yeah, I mean, what Jenny said really resonates with me, that if I get a little cover note that says, this was very therapeutic to write, or whether or not you published this, it was good for me to do this. It's a bit of a warning sign that this has not been processed. This is too recent. This is not, you're not in control. And with this kind of writing, a lot of people think that you don't really use dialogue, and you don't really use scenes, and you're just trying to tell your story, and you're trying to pour it out. And it's really a mistake to approach it that way. You need to tell a story. You need to have a story to tell, and you need to tell a story. Or as someone I was on a panel with said, if you have a really good story, tell it. If you don't have a really good story, write it. Meaning that you can, through very good writing, make a lot of a small moment. But some of the best pieces that I feel that run in Modern Love are good stories simply told. And something about writing for the New York Times, which Jenny would know as she does it often, is clarity is very, very important. It needs to be crystal clear. The reader does not get lost in metaphors or anything else. So you need to be in control of your writing, in control of your emotions.
I'll do one more quick one. This really just goes to Jenny and Margot. Your partners read your books probably in process when they were done. How much do you have them read knowing that they're going to be in it quite frequently? I mean, in the process of writing, do you have your husband, your wife read along the way? Do you present them with what you're going to write at the end? Do you talk to them about what you're going to include? How do you work your partners into your process?
I only did one. And that's because my husband is a heart surgeon, and he wanted to make sure I did not make him Christian Barnard's teacher and the man who performed the first transplant, he thought that I would just go wild. So he corrected in a few places my chapter on him, and he is, in all senses of the word, the last chapter.
I have tried to get my wife to take a more active role in editing the stories. And the chapters as they roll out. She's not a writer, so she's very shy about intruding upon my work. She's a social worker. I think she feels that if she were to tell me how to write the chapter, it would be kind of like if I showed up at a therapy session and started, you know, looking over her shoulder and telling the, you know, the client, you know, oh yeah, don't listen to her. Don't you know, you're fine. So I know writers who have that kind of relationship with the people that they love. I mean, the person that you love has the biggest influence, with any luck, the biggest influence course, I should read your book, Margo. That's the biggest influence on you of anybody. And I think my wife is always afraid that, you know, if she says, well, it was okay. I'll just take it out. It's like, oh, it doesn't work. I'm a failure. my wife reads my work, but then she just kind of says,
Okay. All right, now we'll turn to you guys. So the question is, who wants the back massager?
It's the massage goes first.
I'm going to go to the hand that was right up front for this massager and this question. And
this is for Dan. I'm on. Okay. How much do you edit the submissions to Modern Love? And also, do you share them with other people at the Times? Any of the rejects?
How much do I edit pieces that appear? It varies. It's all over the map. And some pieces, you know, maybe two-thirds of the piece has been gone over in some way. Or, a lot can come out of a phone conversation. Talking about therapy earlier. This is actually where it's useful. I'm not a therapist, and I don't even go to therapy. But in working with a writer, I'm just asking obvious questions, and sometimes some of the most powerful material in the essay comes out of those conversations, and then you need where the space for the column is so precise these days. It used to be more flexible. Now it's like 1,530 words, you know, and if I go below 1,500 words or above 1,540 words, it's not going to fit. So everything comes at a cost, and it's this sort of negotiation when it comes to length. But I can really edit a lot, or sometimes there's that piece that just comes in and it's pretty much ready to go. I can tell you that most editors want something to come in longer than they need it, because as I'm reading it, I'm seeing things that need to come out. And if it comes in at 1,530 words and I'm reading it, then I need to, and all that stuff comes out, I'm going, okay, well, where's this other, how's that space going to be made up for? So anyone submitting to a column should send it a couple hundred words long. In terms of sharing other essays with other people at the Times, I do that. The Times is running more and more personal essays. The Sunday Review section is shifting into the personal essay section almost. And I have received material that wasn't right for Modern Love in one way or another. And I think I have a 100% success rate of getting it to an editor I know there and it running. It just seemed right for them. For one reason or another, they've done it with me too. Less so, I guess. What was the other part of your question? That was it. Okay.
I'm sure somebody has suggested this to you at some point. But have you ever thought that the relationship between you as the editor and the writers that you work with is very much like a relationship between a couple in love, right? Or the opposite of love, depending on the column or the relationship. I mean, that you it is. Although it's kind of one-sided, but it's your job to bring out the best in us, to see our mistakes,
to treat you gently.
Yeah, and then for us to resist and say, well, no, we're not doing it that way, actually. I think you gave me a new ending, or I can't remember. Either I came in long.
Way long.
Really? Okay, we'll talk. But, I mean, it's an irony of doing the column that in some ways, I mean, any editor and an author we do have relationships with editors and writers, and so.
Yeah, it can get very intimate, and I'm not a, I'm a very shy person. At a party, I'm not the life of the party, and I'm not someone. My wife, I have a very talkative wife who sort of represents me in the world. and I find it strange that I'm on these conversations with people. In some cases, asking them very probing, boundary-crossing questions, and just saying, "Sorry, but you know, what does it feel like to have this happen?" That's the part of the job that I've gotten much better at as the years have passed. It's just become almost second nature to just get on the phone with someone and say, So when he spanks you, what does that really? That's not very often that that question comes up.
More's the pity.
We've got a question over here, and you will be getting the tweezers. Yes.
Oh, great. Hi, my name's Elaine, and my question's for Daniel Jones. I'm one of about 10 writers I know in the Boston area who have all been rejected by Modern Love, and we've formed kind of a rejects club. And I've got another one coming for you that you can also reject. But what I've been overwhelmingly curious about is that I've heard that you fact-check essays. And I'm just wondering, how in the world can you do that? Let's say in my case, I sent in an essay about a relationship that I had more than 20 years ago. And so I was thinking, would you have to contact that person to corroborate my story? So I'd just appreciate if you could shed some light on that.
Sure. Yeah, this book tour, after a while, I began to call it the apology tour. Because I would be in a book signing line, and person after person would say, yeah, you've rejected me 7 times. And it's just what happens. Most of the job is about saying no. You know, it's all I do every day is say no. Say once out of every 125. In terms of fact-checking, that's
like
a...
dating also?
I guess so.
Every 125,
so, yeah.
You know,
it's all about love, ultimately. So it's very important that that I have a comfort level with the fact that the story has happened, that the person is not exaggerating, they're not making things up, and I have a process that I go through. It's not like a typical glossy magazine that has a fact-checking section where they're calling someone up to find out all kinds of facts. These stories are personal essays. They're written from memory. Generally, the conversations weren't recorded. So there's sort of an art to making sure that it happened as the person said it happened, and a lot of that can be taken care of in a conversation. There's a lot that you can research online so that you can be reassured of basic truths. At the same time, a personal essay is not a negotiated story among the parties that it involves. So you have to be a little bit careful. I mean, my wife and I fundamentally disagree on how we became engaged. And she remembers it in a more romantic way than I remember it. And that of me doing things that I have no memory of doing, it's possible I blacked out. But I don't remember it that way. And I would write that story one way, and she would write it another way, and we would not agree. And we're entitled to those different stories. So if I'm contacting another person in one of the stories, which happens occasionally, but certainly doesn't happen in every case, and it depends what's at stake. You know, if there's a divorce involved or some legal thing, alcoholism, things where people are being revealed, then it has to become more involved. Most of the stories aren't involved to that degree. But I'm not interested in hearing both sides of the story. I'm interested in reassuring myself that their story is accurate the way they remember it.
Okay. Who's for our third prize? I see one in all the way in the back. Can we get there? I see a white cuff, maybe? Am I blind? Or just a hand? Maybe just a white hand. Straight in the back. There you are.
Did I make it up that you co-edit with your wife?
So this question is for the two women up there, because you've both written about very personal experiences in your lives. And I'm wondering if there is a particular person who has approached you during a signing or during an event and shared a way that your writing has affected their life that you remember fondly, or there's a particular favorite interaction that you could tell us about.
The question was about, is there anyone who's approached you and said that your writing has affected them?
I?
Yeah, you.
No.
Me? It affected me. But make it happen today for her, everyone.
Well, coming after that, this is going to make me sound quite full of myself. But of course, I probably do anyway. It used to be there were just no transgender writers out there at all, or there seemed like there were very few, or that there were very few of us in the public eye.
And I remember in 2003, 4, or 5, people coming to readings where, you know, I remember in particular a mother who had driven to a reading of mine, and they'd come from 100 miles away because her child was trans, and they'd never laid eyes on an actual living transgender person before, ever. And, you know, she just wanted reassurance that it was going to be okay, that her child was going to be all right. And fortunately, now, things have changed so, so much in the last 10 or 12 years that there are lots and lots of trans people in the public eye, and lots of our stories are now getting told. So I don't quite get the same sense, but, you know, I often run into young transgender people who, you know, they want to say, well, I want to be an activist, you know, I want to, you know, and I always say, well, if you want to be an activist, and there are all kinds of ways of being an activist, but the best way of being an activist is tell your story. You know, when I came out to my 85-year-old mother, she said a lot of things, actually. Actually, at the end of the day, she said, well, I don't, it doesn't matter to me, darling, even if you are gay, whatever you are. But she also said, you know, it's impossible to hate anyone whose story you know. And I've never forgotten that. And I think that, in a way, it's one of the things that the Modern Love column does. I think that all writers about relationships try to do is that, you know, if we tell our stories, it's kind of like a lighthouse out there that people know that they're not alone. They're not the only people who've ever experienced something. And I think it's one of the ways that I think we've come to be known to each other, and not just trans people, but anybody who's kind of out of the mainstream, which is at this point pretty much everybody.
And if I can pick up on that, Jenny actually broke the ice in the Modern Love column. Her essay appeared in 2009. The column started in 2004. I not only hadn't published an essay from that perspective, I hadn't received an essay from that perspective in 5 years. And in the early days of the column, I was like, what is this going to be? And a lot of it was trying to represent different experiences and hoping that they would come in. And nothing came in. In fact, I think yours was coming out in an anthology. And I think I found it in an anthology and shortened it from there, so you don't get the blame for it being long.
All right.
and that was the way I got the experience into the column. It was such a plain-spoken, heartfelt essay, and that emboldened people to share their own stories. And it got to the point where I was receiving so many trans stories from different perspectives that I was like, okay, stop. I can't. This
that
is good.
Is lousy
this, is,
with them.
This is good, but this is not the center of the column. It was so nice to see that. And that's happened with, I think the column after a while has generated its own material in that way, where people say, well, she told her story. I want to tell mine. And each one can sort of expose a different side of the crystal.
Have you ever had somebody write in who is like responding to somebody like, you know, like their ex-wife wrote a column, and now the husband is like, all right, let me tell you what really happened. I mean, do you ever have a he said she said or a he said he said?
I did receive one. It wasn't one that was
rebuttal.
It was a rebuttal. It was just a different side of it, but it just wasn't interesting. And
always the way.
Run it.
All right, well, unfortunately, we've run out of time.
No.
I want to give them plenty of time to sign, but I want to say this before we go. You're going to hear from a lot of authors today. Know when I say this that I don't have a secret deal with them. I really encourage you to get these books. As I read all three of them, I thought, if I just order a bunch of these, I have Christmas and Hanukkah covered. But beyond that, I thought, these are really great book club books. They're books that I was hoping my friends would read so I could talk to them about it. So please check them out. Please meet us all in the back over there. And thank you so much for coming. I know it's a gorgeous day, and hopefully it was just as gorgeous inside. Thank you to the three of you.